programs, almost single-handedly bringing the disease under control. The price of inheritance. The widow King, though frail, survived her husband by 40 years. When Robert Kleeberg and Alice King were married in 1886, Henrietta King accompanied them on their honeymoon. This sharing of their postnuptial right established a pattern that continued until her death in 1925. Mrs. King's bedroom in the old frame ranch house was directly across the hall from theirs. When that house burned in 1912, the custom of close family living carried over to the grand hacienda, known as the Big House, that looms over the Santa Gertrudis to this day. Mrs. King presided at the dinner table and was quite free with advice on how the young couple should raise their five children. They never had a life of their own until they themselves were near death. That was the price they paid for their inheritance. For decades, the King Ranch was known as the Widow's Ranch, and Mrs. King, dressed always in black, set the tone for it. Twice a year, she toured the ranch in her heavy black Rockaway coach, and she was, in fact, if not always in practice, the boss of the place. She gave Robert Kleeberg authority and respect, but she never stepped entirely aside. A woman of unflagging charity and Christian determination, she still expected to receive her due as pioneer, founder, and owner. At times, she no doubt made the Kleebergs' lives utterly miserable. But Mrs. King's fussy presence was only a minor source of misery compared with the South Texas climate. It was no more fit for proper Victorians than the steamy plains of India were. The vaquero men and women wore light cottons. The Kleeberg men suffered under wool trousers, high boots, stiff collars, suspenders, and wool coats. The women were gussied up in layers of chemises, petticoats, whalebone corsets, and heavy cloth from head to foot. Dressed like that, simply to survive a South Texas August, was a triumph. Mrs. King would not allow the men to dine at her table in shirt sleeves, no matter how hot the day. And so they would sit through dinner, sweating profusely. If the windows were opened, the wind would cover the plates with dust. If it were a bit cooler, the mosquitoes would descend in clouds. Even so, after dinner, the family members would entertain each other, putting on skits, telling stories, reading aloud and singing songs, always closing with Mrs. King's favorite Rock of Ages. The new generation, the Kleebergs' two boys and three girls, grew up on the ranch in spirit, even though they spent the school year in Corpus Christi. Their father delighted in sending a stagecoach drawn by magnificent white horses to meet them at the train stop. The horses whisked them away on what must have been a heady ride across 20 miles of prairie to the threshold of the ranch house. When the railroad finally came to Kingsville, the railroad manager sent a special engine and a caboose every Friday to take the children from Corpus Christi out to the ranch. Alice King Kleeberg, for her part, stayed in her mother's shadow and deferred to her husband, a model of self-denial. But she harbored in her heart a warm spot for her father's flamboyance. Her first son, Richard Mifflin Kleeberg, was her favorite. He was dashing, talented, and athletic. He mastered languages, golf, the guitar, and the piano, all with ease. He was a natural diplomat with a flair for dramatic gestures and could deliver moving speeches in Spanish, German, and English. He would sit with his mother for hours, playing his guitar and singing songs. But Robert Kleeberg, while he admired his elder son's talents, placed his faith in Robert Kleeberg Jr., his second son. Bob had to work harder for what he got. Shorter than Richard, he was also less athletic and graceful. He had a terrible ear for languages and music, and a soft, squeaky voice unsuited to public speaking. He liked books, but did not take to schools. He pulled his share of pranks, but in contrast to Richard, he was a serious and earnest young man, just the sort to inspire confidence in his father and the widow king. Richard Kleberg, as befitted his talents, became the ranch's emissary to the world at large. He looked after its interests in Congress from 1932 to 1944, and gave a young Texan named Lyndon Johnson his first job in Washington. He was something of a legend there. He often drove up to the Capitol in a stripped-down King Ranch hunting car like the one Buick made for him, trimmed in sterling silver, with compartments for guns, ammunition, and liquor. Bob, however, was given the responsibility of the ranch. Captain King himself had skipped over the most obvious error in favor of a man better suited to the task. That tradition, more than anything else, enabled the family to sustain itself when an aristocracy that gave everything to the firstborn would have failed. And no one proved the tradition's worth more eloquently than Bob Kleberg. In the Captain's Image. 100 years almost to the day after Richard King established his first cow camp on the Santa Gertrudis, Bob Kleberg stood on a rise in Queensland and gazed out on the vast Red Den sweep of the Australian outback. The country was raw desert, worked desultorily by a few settlers and aborigines whose occasional travel sent whirlwinds of dust across the steppes. But Bob Kleberg saw in that Australian wilderness precisely what his grandfather had seen in the grassy, forsaken wild horse desert of South Texas. He saw the makings of an empire. By the time he finally satisfied that vision, he had added 8 million acres of Australian land on long-term leases to the 825,000 or so his family owned in Texas. He also left his mark on every aspect of the original ranch. He led it through the tumultuous decade following the death of Henrietta King in 1925. He survived bitter court battles with his cousins over the division of the ranch. He weathered the Depression and its catastrophic effect on ranch profits. He engineered a deal with Humble Oil for the ranch's oil and gas rights that put it permanently on a sound financial footing, and he developed an entirely new breed of cattle that was to the cattle business what the Model A Ford was to the car business. He was, by any definition, a genius. Like his brother and sisters, Bob Kleberg grew up on the ranch. He learned to ride at 4 and to cut, rope, and shoot soon after. His mentors were his cousin Cesar Kleberg, ranch foreman Sam Raglan, and the Caninos. Cesar was the family eccentric. He ran the southern sector of the ranch from a weathered old ranch house at Narias that had neither electricity nor plumbing. The railroad tracks cut through the front yard. The bathtub was on the front porch, and cots did for beds. The place was so cluttered it was rumored that nothing that went in ever came out, except occasionally Cesar himself. As a boy, Bob lived with Sam Raglan in the foreman's cottage next to the big house. Raglan and Cesar, as well as Caninos like Augustine Quintanilla and Faustino Villa, who had been with Captain King on the river, made the younger Kleberg's son their apprentice. He was a quick learner. With their help, he trained his eyes, his ears, and his nose to pick up the subtle variations that told him, as if by instinct, which calves would breed best, which clouds carried rain, which plant stung, and which one healed. Bob's early ambition was to be an inventor, and later the stirrings of youthful independence caused him to announce that he was going to be an engineer. But the onset of his father's palsy and World War I changed that. He came home to run the ranch in 1918 after only 2 years of college, and for all practical purposes, he did not leave it for 20 years. The ranch divided. In 1925, at the age of 92, the widow of the King Ranch died. At Henrietta King's beer were bankers from the East, railroad executives, oil men, politicians. There were also hundreds of Quineños, some of whom had ridden for 2 days from the ranch's far divisions. Unbidden, they led the funeral procession into the town cemetery, a few miles from where her husband had first brought her to the uninhabited frontier more than 70 years before. Then they circled the open grave on horseback at a fast canter, their hats held at their sides. Mrs. King's death threw the ranch into crisis. The estate taxes and the depression that soon followed dragged the ranch more than $3 million into debt, to the edge of financial ruin. And more ominously, the huge empire built by the riverboat captain had to be divided among his heirs for the first time. That complex and, in some cases, bitter process consumed an entire decade. It was Bob Kleberg's first great test. Mrs. King's will called for her daughter Alice to receive the northern tier of the ranch, the Santa Gertrudis and Laurelis divisions. The southern sector was divided among her other heirs, with the children of Richard King Jr. receiving the Santa Fe Ranch to the west. The Atwoods, heirs of Mrs. King's eldest daughter Nettie, from whom she had long been estranged, never having approved of her marriage to an army officer, received El Suaz on the south. The Klebergs got the northeastern portion known as the Narais Division, to which they added the shares of two other heirs who sold out to them. In the early 20s, knowing his family was going to lose most of the sandy pasture in the southern sector, Bob Kleberg had bought a sandy ranch north of Falfurrias to create another division, the Encino, just north of the Santa Fe Ranch. Of the ranch's 1.2 million acres, the Klebergs ended up with more than 800,000. Throughout the 10 years between Mrs. King's death in 1925 and the final partition in 1935, Bob Kleberg, the youngest trustee, ran the ranch for the heirs. He ran it without hesitation and with a zeal that angered the Atwoods. They fought the will bitterly, challenged his trusteeship, raged over his imperial manner, and fumed that he charged his freewheeling escapades to the estate. Led on by their Chicago lawyer, the Atwoods refused to take El Suaz and sued the ranch for nearly 20 years, all the while living in comparative poverty on a modest allowance Mrs. King had given them in her will. Estranged, lonely, and resentful, one of them bequeathed her estate to a Chicago policeman who had treated her kindly. The lawyer ended up with well over half of El Suaz in return for masterminding what was, by the time it was finally settled in the 50s, the longest suit in Texas history. To manage their holdings, in 1934, the Klebergs incorporated the King Ranch, which meant that the descendants of Richard King Jr. would no longer be a part of the ranch that bore their name. Each of the 5 children of Alice King and Robert Kleberg Sr. got 1/5 of the stock, each which they pooled in a trust set up to last until 1954, when they or their heirs would control the stock individually. The intent was clear. After suffering through the tense decade following Mrs. King's death, Bob Kleberg, his brother Richard, and their 3 sisters were pledging to keep the King Ranch together. The incorporation of the ranch was the beginning of its modern history. It was no longer one man's empire. Now it belonged to a growing family whose members would have to agree on its destiny. In 1934, there were only 5 stockholders. In 2 generations, there would be more than 60. Corporate politics, meaning family politics, would decide the ranch's future, even if the will, charisma, and above all, the longevity of Bob Kleberg would obscure that fact for 4 decades. Back in the early 30s, however, Bob worried less about how his heirs would run the ranch than about making sure they would have something to run. Neither the Atwoods, the land, nor the future was the biggest thorn in his side. Money was. Playing the oil card. Ranchers have traditionally been land poor, long on acres, short on cash. Ever since the brief halcyon years of the cattle boom following the Civil War, the King Ranch had seldom earned more than $100,000 or $5,200,000 a year in profit from all its ranching operations. Some years it lost money. In the 30s, however, drought so parched the ranch's pastures that its cattle were starving. Yet there was no point in buying feed for them. Fat steers were selling for a pitiful 3.5 cents a pound. The King Ranch unloaded thousands of head and earned in return barely enough to pay for shipping them to market. It was a grim period. Bob's cousin Richard King, who was still with the ranch then, spent all his time on trains, trying to stay ahead of the ranch's creditors by floating new loans to pay off the old ones coming due. Throughout the crisis, the elder Kleberg, the older German lawyer who had bested a riverboat captain in court, still got in his car every afternoon and had himself driven around the ranch, his blue eyes staring out at the barren plains, his once fertile mind now made helpless by a stroke. The pressure on Bob to sell off big chunks of the ranch, to throw into the fire the only asset it had left, its land, became overwhelming. No one saw any way out. But Bob obstinately and unreasonably refused to sell land. Selling is easy, he would say. Collecting is hard. He looked instead to something else the ranch possessed beneath its surface. He looked to oil. In 1933, Bob Kleberg tried to persuade several oil companies to take a lease on the ranch. Gulf, Shell, and Texaco turned him down. Humble Oil did not. In return for a loan that would assume all the ranch's $3 million debt, then held by numerous investors in the form of King Ranch notes, and in return for a royalty interest and enough bonus payments to meet the interest on the loan, Bob granted Humble the right to search for oil and gas on the more than 1 million acres the family controlled before the partition. When the deal was closed, Humble had possession of what was then the largest oil and gas lease in the world, and the ranch provided, as many oil men doubted, that there was oil under its pastures, was on sound financial footing at last. Using the primitive geological survey methods of the time, Humble spent the next 6 years trying to discover just where to drill its first well. It was like firing a rocket into space, not knowing where the planets were and expecting to hit something, a veteran of the early exploration recalled. In 1939, Humble began drilling in the sections adjacent to proven fields outside the ranch. It was not until 1945, 12 years after the lease was signed, that they went after new fields with their first Wildcat well. It hit. 2 years later, the ranch had raked in $3.25 million in royalties from fields that the Oil and Gas Journal estimated would be second to East Texas in oil and second to Amarillo in natural gas. By 1953, there were 650 producing wells on the ranch. The relationship between the King Ranch and Humble was based on a simple understanding. The King Ranch might be an oil field to Humble, but it was still a ranch to Bob Kleberg. For example, when the first oil well was no longer a producer, it was converted to a water well and used to fill stock tanks. Oil has been a considerate guest. Pumps, rigs, gas lines, and equipment are kept up to the standard of appearance of the ranch, which, not so incidentally, got with its royalties a free system of roads and free natural gas. The free gas eventually became something of a headache for Humble. On one memorable occasion, the top executives of Standard Oil, Humble, and other oil companies were house guests of Henrietta Larkin Armstrong, Bob's sister. Henrietta was an enthusiastic gardener. That night, a blue norther sent the temperature in South Texas into the 20s, so Henrietta set out dozens of gas stoves to keep her plants from freezing. Sometime after midnight, the stoves stopped working. With undeniable logic, she rousted all the oil company presidents and board chairmen out of their beds with the command, "You all know everything about gas. Get up and fix my stoves." They did, and not long after that, gave up supplying the ranch with free gas from their wells and installed propane tanks instead. An artist of genetics. Bob Kleberg not only saved the ranch, he also transformed it. Like Henry Ford, with whom he had a great deal in common, he loved to tinker. Were the mesquite thickets getting worse? He invented a root plow driven by a massive bulldozer that could clear 4 acres an hour. Were the native grasses thin and undernourishing? He developed his own grasses, some of which are now used around the world. Was the grass deficient in nutrients? He devised a phosphorus supplement that made cattle healthier. Was it difficult to move cattle into pens? He invented the cattle prod, based on the design for a fly electrocutor he was experimenting with. The list goes on, but his most inventive work was in breeding. By World War I, the longhorn, like the buffalo, had vanished from the frontier. But the English breeds that replaced it suffered mightily in the South Texas heat. Most of the year they ran a fever just from standing in the sun. Their skin was too tight to allow much evaporation and too thin to resist screwworms, ticks, and other insects. They gained weight poorly when fed just grass, yet grass was what the King Ranch had in abundance. With the help of his brother, Richard, Bob Kleberg set out to invent his own cow. He brought in Brahmins and crossed them with his English shorthorns, patiently working down through generations of cattle until one day a bull calf was born that seemed different. He was so good-natured and playful that they called him Monkey. Monkey was what Bob Kleberg had been looking for, and from Monkey he engineered a whole new race of cattle. To breed out undesirable characteristics, he repeatedly mated Monkey to a hand-picked selection of other crossbreeds, then to the best offspring from those matings and to their offspring. He would look at young bulls and heifers and announce that they would nick well together, would produce calves that would continue the progress toward his goal, an animal that would thrive on heat and grass and would repel insects, an animal that had the hardiness of the Brahmin and the temperament and marketable beef of the fat and docile English cattle. His invention was the world's first new breed of beef cattle in more than a century, and in 1940, thanks largely to Richard Kleberg's skilled lobbying in Washington, it was officially named the first American breed. Bob Kleberg called the new breed the Santa Gertrudis, after the little creek that marked the spot of King's first rancho. The breed reflects Bob's practical genius, but it also confirms his artistic sense. It is an animal of beauty, deep russet in color, long and well proportioned. Like great art, the Santa Gertrudis appears simple, but could only be recreated from scratch with incredible difficulty and a great deal of luck. Technically, it is 3/8 Brahmin and 5/8 Shorthorn. But as one geneticist puts it, you could cross Shorthorns and Brahmins all your life and not come up with a Santa Gertrudis. Bob Kleberg's artistry and genetics wasn't limited to beef cattle. His father had crossed quarter horses with thoroughbreds and standard breeds, but their descendants were too clumsy for ranch work. Bob set out to create a ranch horse that would be, in his words, a joy to ride. The quarter horse he developed, known as the Old Sorrel, from the stallion that was the equine counterpart of Monkey, is a deep red like the Santa Gertrudis. Ringling Brothers bought King Ranch quarter horses for their circus acts, and when the American Quarter Horse Association was founded, a King Ranch stallion, Wimpy, was given the first number in the stud book. In the late 30s, Bob devoted the same interest to thoroughbreds, breeding racehorses that won the Kentucky Derby twice, and, with Assault, the Triple Crown. In each case, he pushed out into the forefront of the geneticist's art and science. Outside the fences. Bob Kleberg was the first leader of the King Ranch, born and bred to ranching. He did not share his father's interest in development and growth. If anything, the town Kingsville, his father's personal creation, was an irritant to him. Still, he did not want to let Kingsville leave the ranch's paternal control. The family was proud of the land and money it donated for schools, churches, and social work, not to mention the leadership of generations of ranch women in charitable causes throughout South Texas. Bob Kleberg was squarely in that tradition. He saw himself as a patron. In that role, he donated buildings and money for schools, but fought any effort to let the school board tax the ranch to pay for the same improvement. The arrival of a naval air station, Humble, and then the Celanese Chemical Company, combined with the social upheavals that began in earnest after World War II, changed forever the ranch's relationship to Robert Kleberg's town. Like a son who had grown to manhood, Kingsville wanted independence from its parents. First, Richard Kleberg was defeated for Congress. Then, in the late 40s, Kingsville voted in an anti-ranch school board. But today, the town and the ranch coexist comfortably. The ranch pays about $336,000 in taxes, less than either Celanese or Humble. The streets bear the names of the family, and the ranch still owns the newspaper, the largest bank, a lumber yard, and a boot and saddle shop. But Kingsville and its 29,000 people have grown beyond the ranch, just as the ranch, in its worldwide activities, has grown beyond Kingsville. The family, of course, did not drop out of politics. After Richard broke with the New Deal, the Klebergs gradually became strong Republicans. In 1962, John Armstrong, now the ranch's executive vice president, modernized the Kleberg County Republican Party organization and personally helped canvass the whole county. Both Bob Kleberg and his nephews, Belton Kleberg, B. Johnson, and Dick Kleberg, strongly supported Richard Nixon. Dick contributed $100,000 to Nixon's 1972 campaign. And when Nixon resigned the presidency in 1974, a stunned and very distressed Bob Kleberg, only 2 months away from death, called one of his relatives to talk for hours about the fate of leaders, about how no man can hold power forever. But in local politics, the ranch takes a lower profile. For a number of Chicano activists, the ranch is too potent a symbol of how Anglo ranchers once controlled the county's destiny. Some individual family members still get involved in city and school elections, and the family-owned newspaper is fairly outspoken on local affairs, but no one in either the town or the family believes the ranch calls the shots in Kingsville anymore. Taxes weren't the only trappings of civilization that Bob resisted. The boom in the valley in South Texas, brought on in part by the success of his father's farming experiments, was attracting too many people, crowding out cattle, eating away at perfectly good ranch land. He ruthlessly set out to stop this encroachment, once calling one of the elder Kleberg's farming proposals a damn fool idea to his face. For almost 10 years, he and Johnny Kennedy, Mifflin Kennedy's grandson, blocked the completion of Highway 77, the main artery between Corpus Christi and Brownsville, because it would pass through their ranches. His opposition to progress earned the ranch its fame as the Walled Kingdom. Miles to go before he slept. When Bob Kleberg went to Australia in 1952, he was 56. The ranch he had run since 1918, when he was 22 years old, was doing well. Now, at a time when many men would have looked back on their accomplishments, he was ready for new challenges. He was irascible, magnetic, imperious, opinionated, able to mix with vaqueros and Rockefellers, and quite often absolutely impossible. "I've been out with him when he didn't put head to pillow all night," recalls John Armstrong. "Then he'd saddle up his horse and work cattle until the sun went down the next day, and never slow down. I never knew when he slept, but I started to notice that he would sleep at the dinner table, sometimes over coffee, sometimes through the main course. And then he'd look up with a start and be ready to go again. When you were with him, you were always drinking, laughing, and shooting rabbits. I went with him to South America, and when I came home, I had to see my doctor. I was almost 25 years younger, but he had worn me out. When he went to the East, to the best boxes at Saratoga, to the suite at the Pierre, to 21, he arrived as the conquering provincial. During the horse racing season, he customarily dressed in a silk hat with a serape and, thus outfitted, went calling on the Whitneys and the Vanderbilts. There was always something fabulous about him, almost as if he had just ridden up to the Pierre Hotel surrounded by mounted and armed quinceañeros. What Bob saw, he saw clearly. What Bob wanted done, he got done. He was not plagued by self-doubts or hampered by lack of confidence. He did as he pleased all his life. He knew his own mind, and he knew who he was. Faced with a world in which paperwork, bureaucrats, and experts assumed more importance every day, he became less and less patient with dissent, incompetence, and routine. A lifelong friend casually refers to him as the old dictator. He wanted things done his way. When he said frog, one crusty South Texas rancher and oil man recalls, everybody jumped. Instinct was as important to Bob Kleberg as organization. The management tools used in sedentary pursuits like insurance and steel manufacturing were to be tolerated, but certainly not encouraged. When he went to Venezuela to look into buying a ranch with his partner there, he was presented with a wealth of statistics, charts, and cost-benefit analyses. He brushed them all aside, looked around at the land, opened a bottle, and made the deal. After all, his partner in Venezuela was a man he trusted, a rancher. That bond of respect was worth more than any economic analysis. The partner, Gustavo de los Reyes, had owned a ranch in Cuba, neighboring Bob Kleberg's first foreign venture. After Castro came to power in 1959, de los Reyes was imprisoned, and the king's ranch's property and cattle were expropriated. For years afterward, there were reports of Santa Gertrudis herds in Russia, the older cattle still bearing the ranch's Running W brand. Kleberg had promised de los Reyes he would set him up anywhere in the world when he got out of prison, and he kept his promise. In 1966, Bob was visiting the Venezuela ranch. Terrorists had been attacking ranches nearby, and the Venezuelan government seemed powerless to stop them. As de los Reyes recounted the story to Charles Murphy, a fortune writer, he turned to Kleberg and told him he wouldn't blame him if he wanted to pull out of the Venezuela in order to avoid a repeat of the Cuban affair. Kleberg thought about that. "You ever run away from anything?" he asked. "Nothing that I can remember," the Cuban answered. "Neither have I," said Captain King's grandson. Bob Kleberg then stood up, took off his King Ranch cowboy hat and hung it on a hook in the ranch office, where it remained until his death. I'll need this, he said, when I come back. That was how Bob Kleberg worked, in ranching, in oil, in everything. He had an actor's instinct for the dramatic gesture, particularly the one that would make him seem larger than life. But if he postured, as he did with his hat in Venezuela, he was also willing to back that posturing up. He might, for example, trot out some obscure fact about the Irish Rebellion in 1797 to make a point, but if he was challenged, the chances were very good that he really knew what he was talking about. He did a great deal for effect, but he hardly ever did anything simply for show. A sophisticated businessman, he was a determined foe of what passed for sophisticated business. After he made a deal, he had his lawyers and accountants come in and make sure it was right, but until then, they made themselves scarce. He had a healthy respect for such professionals. His father and brother were both lawyers, and the ranch's main attorneys, Leroy Denham Sr. and Leroy Denham Jr., were two of his closest friends and advisors. But he knew also that a rancher was not a lawyer, and that to be a rancher, you had to know when not to return your lawyer's urgent phone calls. A woman's touch. For the last two decades of his life, Bob Kleberg spent most of his time on his foreign empire. His nephew Dick Kleberg stayed in Texas and ran the original ranch. When Bob was at the ranch, his days almost always followed the same pattern. He was awakened with a steaming cup of black coffee at 5 or 6, talked to all his foremen by phone, and then drove out onto the ranch in one of the special hunting cars he had designed. He never left without his pistols and his Mannlicher rifles. There was always the possibility of some hapless coyote, or during hunting season, quail, turkey, or deer might cross his path. Throughout the day, he would work on horseback with the Quinenos. At lunch, they would break for barbecue, frijoles, and camp bread cooked in Dutch ovens over an open fire and smeared with molasses. It was a rugged, hardy, outdoor life. It kept Bob Kleberg in touch with his roots and with the frontier traditions of ranching, and it had almost nothing to do with how the ranch really made its money. When he returned from his sojourns in Australia or South America, Bob made it a point to tour the ranch. His tours were legendary. Often he would take his nephew, B. Johnson, along. We'd leave at dawn and drive all day long, B. remembers. We'd do 2 and sometimes 3 divisions in a day. He'd get to a pasture, take one look, and say, I told you 3 years ago to do so-and-so. You didn't do it. See what happened? He would work with the Quinenos, straight through until we finished. No breaks for coffee, lunch, bad weather, or anything. He did everything the hard way. He rode the hard way, with his stirrups fully extended. He roped the hard way, just using his shoulders. He studied the hard way, always poring over scientific journals. He hated the office. His life was outside. Bob and his brother and their few close friends entertained themselves much as Captain King had. They hunted, of course, alone and with each other, and on a grand social scale at Christmas time. Both Bob and Richard were superb shots with rifle, pistol, or shotgun. Once Bob and a family friend shot out the streetlights of the nation's capital with wild abandon and great accuracy. Bob and Richard often bet on horses and sneaked away from the respectable life of the family compound to the more plebeian pleasures of cockfighting. Their mother Alice, the last link with the old ranch of Captain King, viewed their excesses with the same blinders her mother had worn. When someone mentioned that her son Richard was spending a good deal of time with fighting cocks, she replied, "How nice. He's the first member of the family to be interested in poultry." But at home, the brothers made the same concessions to respectability their grandfather had. They would, for example, hide liquor the bathroom and answer a truly prodigious number of calls of nature during parties or in the long evenings they spent at home. Outside the house, they were their own men. Inside, they played by women's rules. But Alice King Kleberg was the last woman of the family to embody the struggle of gentility against reality. The next generation of women was different, as likely to sip bourbon as the men, as eager to go out on roundups, as proficient at riding and shooting. The key woman of that generation was Bob's wife, Helen, the model for Leslie Benedict in Giant. If oil opened the world up to the ranch, it was Helen who pushed it and prodded her reluctant husband out into it. The daughter of a congressman from Kansas, she met Bob Kleberg at a party in 1926. Only 17 days later, they were married. Helen threw herself into the romantic and varied wonders of the ranch, but always, always tried to awaken her provincial husband to what lay beyond its fences. She encouraged him to enter the world of thoroughbred racing, which led them into friendships with old families of the East. She bought her cowboy husband pinstripe suits, which he wore with good humor, even if they never quite seemed to fit. She carried her Episcopalian faith into the Presbyterian stronghold, and determined that her daughter, Helenita, and other promising young Klebergs would be exposed to a wider world, she saw that they went east to prep school. She labored to keep up a sense of standards within the fairly rough-edged family she had joined. She even included the Queen of England on the family's wedding invitation list, a reminder to everyone of exactly where she pegged the Klebergs' social position. Every January at roundup time, Bob and Helen Kleberg worked cattle together. Everyone pitched in for a veritable orgy of work and a hell of a good time. It was as if twice a year John D. Rockefeller went down to the oil field and drilled for oil. Few people of the Kleberg station remained so in touch with the work on which their fortunes were built, and few people of their station could perform the roughest and most challenging tasks as well as their best workers.
Next week, please tune in for part 3 of Texas Monthly Articles about the King Ranch, read by our volunteer, Jack.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour, stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack.
Next, on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, the Noon Book Hour, followed by the Coronavirus Update at 1.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 66 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the mid-50s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the mid-70s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the upper 50s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 12 noon.
It's time for the Noon Book Hour. Readings of books from all genres, handpicked by staff at the Recording Library of West Texas.
Dreamscape presents Turkey Day Murder, a Lucy Stone Mystery by Leslie Meyer, narrated by Karen White. After the bright, albeit waning, sunshine outside, it took a few minutes for her eyes to adjust to the dim light inside the barn. It was surprisingly warm, and she pulled off her beret and jammed it in her pocket. "Over here!" yelled O'Hara, and she finally made him out, standing by Tom Turkey's pen. As she got closer and her vision cleared, she was shocked to see he was wearing a leather motocross suit. "I took you for the kind of guy who drives a Lexus or a BMW," she said in a teasing tone. "You'd be right," he said, smiling. "I've got a Lexus, but I ride my bike whenever I can. It's great exercise, and a lot more fun than sweating on a treadmill in some stinking gym. A lot more dangerous, too, said Lucy, thinking of the cyclist who had harassed her on the back road, and wondering if it could possibly have been O'Hara. She thought of Bear Sykes and his cell phone, but dismissed the thought. It seemed unlikely that O'Hara would be at Sykes's beck and call. It must have been one of the young toughs Ted had told her about. She relaxed. "Where's Andy?" she asked, glancing uneasily at the turkey, who was pacing back and forth in his pen. "I don't think old Tom-Tom here cares much one way or the other about the casino." "That's where you're wrong," said O'Hara with mock seriousness. "Before you got here, he was telling me he loves to play blackjack." "I think craps is more his style," said Lucy, wrinkling her nose. "You may be right," agreed O'Hara, unrolling the plans and laying them out on a stack of hay bales. The sun was sinking lower in the sky, and it streamed through the high windows, lighting the entire area in a golden glow. "Andy had to make some phone calls, but he said he'd be right over." Lucy stepped closer, studying the blue and white diagram. "This is what they call an elevation," O'Hara said. "It shows what the casino will look like from the southeast, actually the main entrance." Lucy looked at the rounded awning, which was reminiscent of a longhouse. She noticed the carvings of a bear and turtle that stood on either side of the doorway. Her eyes followed the soaring lines of the hotel tower, and she counted the rows of windows. 14 stories. It seems so big. Bigger than anything we've ever seen in Tinker's Cove. I know, but what would you rather have? A tall building like this, or a sprawling complex covering acres of land? I guess I never thought of it that way, said Lucy. This is so much more economical. It's energy efficient. O'Hara paused, looking at her. You know, I'll never understand you country folk. You got all this empty land, acres and acres of it, and you all act like one building is going to spoil it. What gives? Lucy shrugged. People around here like it the way it is. I noticed. He tapped the plans with his finger. You can't hold back progress, you know. Whether you like it or not, things are going to change in Tinker's Cove, with or without the casino. If the tribe gets federal recognition, the whole balance of power is going to change. It won't be Howard White and his buddies calling the shots anymore. And your boss, Ted? He's awfully cocky for a guy whose entire livelihood is tied up in that rickety newspaper. I mean, think what one carelessly thrown match could do to that place. Lucy's head jerked up, and she stared at O'Hara. Is that why you had me come here? To send a message to Ted that you're going to torch the penny saver if he doesn't support the casino? O'Hara had been getting the full force of the slanting sunlight. It was so bright, it illuminated the dancing dust particles in the air. Beads of perspiration had formed on his upper lip, and he wiped them away with his hand. You've got me wrong, said O'Hara, unzipping his jacket. I just think people should think things through before they make big decisions. That's good advice for... began Lucy, stammering to a halt as her eyes fell on the short black thread that dangled from the neck of his sweater. It should have held a button, a woven leather button, just like the ones that remained. Well, for anyone, she continued brightly, hoping he hadn't noticed her staring. It's just common sense, she babbled on, wondering if O'Hara's missing button was the missing button. What my mother used to tell me, think before you speak. O'Hara nodded and leaned forward to pull out another plan, and she instinctively stepped back. He looked at her curiously. I think if you keep an open mind when you look at these plans, you'll have to agree the casino could be a real asset to the town. Look here, we've used a woodland theme, A brook with waterfalls actually runs through the gaming area, and there will be recordings of birdsong. The furniture will be Adirondack style, like a lodge, right down to a gigantic fieldstone fireplace. He tapped the plan with his finger, inviting Lucy to step forward and take a closer look. She knew she should do it, but she couldn't make her feet move. All she could think about was that missing button. "I know casinos aren't everybody's cup of tea," he said, sensing her discomfort. "Let me show you the shopping concourse. It's truly magnificent. It has a 4-story waterfall." As he spoke, Lucy came to a decision. She had to get out of there. She'd make up an excuse, a little white lie, and leave. "You know," she said, making a show of checking her watch, "I just realized that I have to pick up my daughter from Brownies. Damn it. If only she could take her eyes off that darn sweater." But no matter how hard she tried, her gaze kept returning to the sight of that dangling thread. "I thought you said you had until 4, when the selectmen have their meeting?" His eyes had become flat, and his tone was insistent. "I'm sorry, I just forgot about the scout meeting. I really do have to go," insisted Lucy, wishing she had never agreed to meet O'Hara. "I only have a few more points to go over with you," he said firmly. "It won't take long." Looking through the long barn, Lucy could see the door, still ajar. More than anything, she wanted to go through it. "I can't stay," she said. "I really have to pick up my daughter." "Can't she wait for a few minutes?" His tone was unexpectedly vehement, and it struck Lucy that O'Hara was a man used to getting his own way, a man who didn't like to be crossed. 10 minutes, she said, hoping he'd accept a compromise. Besides, she was probably just being silly. There was no sense jumping to conclusions. Lots of people wore those sweaters. What had Horowitz said? Every man in America had something with that kind of button in his closet. Furthermore, she knew they tended to fall off. How many times had she replaced the buttons on Bill's sport coat? Having a missing button wasn't a crime, and it didn't mean O'Hara was a murderer. The sooner she went along with him, she told herself, the sooner she'd get out of there. Her best bet was to behave as normally as possible without giving him a hint of her suspicions. She could keep a poker face as well as anyone. "How many stores in the shopping concourse?" she asked, trying to sound interested. 40 or so, ranging from high-end jewelry and fur boutiques to souvenirs and t-shirts. "This is a much bigger project than I imagined," she said. "Mulligan is one of the biggest construction companies in the Northeast," he boasted. "We only do big projects." "Really?" Lucy decided to lay on the flattery. "And you're in line to be the next CEO?" "I don't know where Howard White gets off saying stuff like that." He glanced at Tom Tom, who was still regarding them suspiciously from his pen. "One thing I've learned in business is never to count your chickens, or your turkeys, before they're hatched. There are plenty of foxes sniffing around, believe me." "From what Howard said, it sounded like a sure thing." "No way. I've got a lot of competition for the job." He looked at the plans. "Of course, if I can make a go of this thing, it would give me a real advantage." He paused and smiled smugly. "You see, this casino project is my baby." "What do you mean? Didn't the Matinicotts hire you?" "No way. It was my idea," he said. "You see, I've known Andy for a long time. We went to college together. When he told me the local tribe was trying to get federal recognition, I approached Bear Sykes. He hadn't even thought of a casino until I mentioned it. I mean, of course they'd thought of it, but they hadn't come to any decision." Lucy nodded. "From what Ellie told me, They were mostly interested in maintaining their heritage and establishing a cultural identity. "Whoa," said O'Hara, holding up his hands in protest. "If I hear those words one more time, I mean, what do they want? We've got bears and turtles and babbling brooks and fucking bird songs. Pardon my French, but that wasn't enough. Not for Mr. Nolan. It wasn't enough that this casino can generate enough money for the entire tribe to go live in Tahiti if they want, for God's sake. But he's nitpicking every little thing. Talk about bad timing. Just when we need to grease the wheels, he comes in throwing sand around. That guy made a big mistake when he tangled with me." O'Hara suddenly realized he'd said too much. "Not that I had anything to do with his death." "Of course not," said Lucy, backing away from him. "That never crossed my mind." O'Hara's eyes were fixed on something in the corner. Lucy followed his gaze and recognized a maul, an oversized mallet with a steel head used to force a wedge through a log to split it into firewood. "Of course I'm not shedding any tears for him," said O'Hara, picking up the maul and checking its heft. "I guess you could call it a lucky break." Lucy had split plenty of wood in the days when they'd heated their house with a wood stove, and she knew to the ounce exactly how heavy a maul was. She had once dropped one on her foot, which had turned black and blue for weeks. She didn't even want to think about the damage one could cause if it were used as a weapon. She looked toward the door, estimating the distance. If she made a run for it, would she make it? Not unless O'Hara was distracted, she decided. "I've always believed you make your own luck," said Lucy, nervously backing up against the turkey pen and reaching in her coat pocket. Behind her, she could hear Tom Tom making throaty noises. "Things seem to be going pretty well for you. You wouldn't want to do anything foolish." "One thing I know," he said, stepping toward her. "You don't get ahead by being indecisive. You can't be afraid to take risks." He started to lift the maul, and Lucy knew he planned to kill her, just as he'd killed Kurt Nolan. She edged away from him and reached deeper in her pocket, finally finding what she was looking for, the red beret she had stuffed there earlier. She pulled it out, waving it and tossing it straight at O'Hara. He instinctively ducked and grabbed for it, giving Lucy an opportunity to unlatch the gate of Tom Tom's pen. Enraged by the sight of the red beret in O'Hara's hand, the huge bird went straight for his supposed rival. Caught off balance by the unexpected attack, O'Hara went flying and landed on his seat in a pile of straw. Tom Tom cocked his head, blinked his eyes, and decided he'd been so successful at cutting this guy down to size that he might as well finish him off. He puffed out his chest, spread his tail, and renewed his attack. Lucy didn't wait to watch. She started to run for the door, but stopped in her tracks when it flew open, and Kudo ran in, followed by Barney Culpepper. "Hold it right there," bellowed Barney, reaching for his gun. O'Hara froze, holding the maul at shoulder height and keeping a wary eye on the turkey. Tom Tom, however, was no longer interested in attacking him. He was checking out a new opponent, Kudo, who had faced off opposite him, growling. "You're under arrest," Barney told O'Hara. "Put the maul down and put your hands behind your back." "What's the charge?" demanded O'Hara, cocky as ever. "Mistreating an animal will do for starters," said Barney, snapping on the cuffs. Her knees shaking, Lucy stroked Kudo's thick ruff. He wagged his tail, then jumped at Tom Tom, sending the turkey scurrying for the safety of his pen. Lucy fastened the catch with trembling hands. Then she collapsed on her knees, burying her nose in the dog's fur and hugging him. He tolerated this embarrassing display for a few seconds, then pulled away, cocking his head and pricking up his ears. "You're right," said Lucy. "It's time to get out of here." Chapter 22. Lucy had just put Kudo in the car when she heard sirens. So did the Browns, who began pouring out of the house and streaming down the hill to the barnyard. "About time," thought Lucy, slamming down the hatch. "Where were you when I needed you?" Andy led the group, marching up to Barney and demanding, "What's going on?" Marion Brown stood a few steps behind him, wiping her hands on her apron and keeping an eye on the kids. "I'm making an arrest," said Barney, lifting off his cap and running his hand through his brush cut before replacing it. Andy peered in the back of the cruiser, then raised his eyebrows in shock when he recognized Jack O'Hara. "There must be some mistake," he declared. "That's Jack."
"Excuse me," said Marion, stepping